All right, Matthew 26. So let's jump into the text here. We're looking at the final Passover that Jesus would observe with his disciples. And that Passover coincides with the weekend of his death and his burial and then his resurrection. And so Matthew chapter 26, let's read verses 1 through 5. Just a reminder that the lessons with the questions that you'll see are always between the double doors in the back. Questions for next week are also back there. Bulletins for today are back there with today's sermon outline. We're a little low on bulletins because we're having copy machine issues, so hopefully those will get fixed by next week. And lessons for Wednesday are also on the table in the lobby as well. All right, Matthew chapter 26, verses 1 through 5. It says, "Now the feast of unleavened bread drew near, which is called Passover. Now it came to pass, when Jesus had finished all these sayings, that he said to his disciples, 'You know that after 2 days is the Passover, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified.'" So Jesus is given a very specific timeline here. Prior to this, Jesus has just said, "Hey, I'm going to suffer and I'm going to be crucified." But here he tells his disciples that after 2 days, the Son of Man is going to be delivered up to be crucified. Very specific, as he knows the timing. "And after 2 days, it was the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread." And so if we mashed up Matthew 26, Mark 14, Luke 22, this is what it would look like. "And the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders of the people assembled at the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas, and plotted to take Jesus and sought how they might take him by trickery and kill him, for they feared the people. But they said, 'Not during the feast, lest there be an uproar among the people.'" There are a lot of people in Jerusalem for this feast. And so they are somewhat concerned that if they do this during the feast, because of the popularity of Jesus — Jesus is a very polarizing figure. Some people loved him, some people hated him. Because of the popularity of Jesus, they were afraid that this could cause an uproar during the feast, which the Romans, who they were subjugated to at this point in time, would not have looked kindly upon. They were willing to allow the Jews to practice their religion so long as their religion did not create disturbances in the Roman Empire. And so the Jews are concerned, the leaders of the Jews are concerned about that for multiple reasons. And coming into Roman conflict would have been one of them. All right, so when you read these three passages, there's two Jewish feasts that are drawing near. And the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, it's almost stated in the Scriptures like they were the same thing. They were two different things, but they happened around the same time. So they became very synonymous with one another. It's like if you refer to the celebration of Christmas, well, some people might celebrate that on Christmas Eve. Some people might do that on Christmas Day. They might just call it broadly Christmas, even though one might be celebrating on the 24th, one might be celebrating on the 25th. Here, the Passover officially began on the 14th of Nisan. And the Feast of Unleavened Bread began on the 15th of Nisan. So the day after. The Passover was a one-day event. The Feast of Unleavened Bread was a full week-long event. Yet, because they happened so close to one another, they were kind of stated in synonymous terms. They were celebrated together. And so in the text, the terms are often used interchangeably. The purpose of this feast was to commemorate the deliverance from Egypt. Exodus 12 is where the first Passover is celebrated. And so that's what's going on here when we get to Matthew chapter 26. So what are the enemies of Jesus doing, which would soon prove the prediction of Jesus to be correct? What are they doing during this preparation and celebration of the Feast of Passover? They're plotting to kill him, right? So they've gathered together and they're plotting. When would be the perfect time, the perfect situation? You know, Jesus is back on our turf now. And so what can we do to try to arrest and convict him? So what fortunate situation seems to fall into their hands to make it possible? Who comes to them? Judas. Yeah. So they're thinking about how can we do this? How can we find him? They're trying to guess at where he's going to be. And then Judas walks in. The disciple of Jesus, who knows where Jesus is going to be late at night, and says, how much will you give me to betray him to you? So Judas's money gets the best of him, his love for money. And obviously they see this as a fortunate situation. We have one of the friends of Jesus who can tell us where he will be located at a specific time in the evening. That's when everybody's kind of gone to their homes and they're resting for the evening. And so we can do this under the darkness of night, the cover of darkness, so that we can arrest him and put him to trial and crucify him. So Judas falls into their hands. And that's what Matthew 26, 14 through 16 states. It says, then Satan entered Judas, surnamed Iscariot, who is numbered among one of the 12. And so he went his way to the chief priests and captains and conferred how he might betray him to them, and said, what are you willing to give me if I deliver him to you? And when they heard it, they were glad, because they're thinking, this is great. This is going to work out really well for us. And they promised and agreed to give him money, and they counted out to him 30 pieces of silver. So from that time, he promised and sought opportunity how he might conveniently betray him to them in the absence of the multitude. So that's how it worked out. So the enemies of Jesus enlist Judas. I'm not going to make you answer that question because it's pretty obvious. What do we know about the character of Judas from other Bible passages? What do we know about his character?
He was with the 12. He was a thief.
Okay.
He was there in charge of the money back.
Mm-hmm. Good. He was one of the 12. He was a thief. Now, John tells us that after the fact, because John's writing one of the later Gospels. But when in John's Gospel, John points out that he used to take money out of the money bag. In fact, that's why he complained, why didn't we sell this ointment for, you know, so many pieces of silver, because he was hoping he could skim a little off the top, John tells us, right? So he had already a nature where this was kind of his pet sin, if you will. He was a greedy person. Different people are tempted in different ways, and for Judas, his temptation was with money. He had money issues. He was tempted to steal, to take, to embezzle. And that's what leads him to conspire with the chief priests. And so, character issue. And that character issue leads to the betrayal of Jesus. The scriptures show us a pretty downward spiral in the life of Judas afterwards. Jesus knows that Judas is going to be his betrayer. In John 13, he calls him out in verse 27. Judas shows up with the Jewish mob, and so we're going to see that, and it's stated to us in John 18. He's the one that comes up and kisses Jesus on the cheek to give him away. And after his betrayal, though, Judas feels regret, and Judas kills himself. We read in Matthew 27, and he is replaced by Matthias prior to Pentecost in Acts chapter 1. So, downward spiral in the life of Judas from this point forward. Take a look at what McGarvey writes in his commentary. He says, there were many at the feast from Galilee and other sections of the country where Jesus ministered. And judging by the demonstration made at the triumphal entry, they felt that there were plenty to take arms in Jesus' behalf. The sense of their counsel, therefore, seemed to be that if Jesus could be taken by subtlety, that is, arrested privately, he might be taken during the feast. But if he had to be arrested publicly, then it was better to postpone his apprehension until after the feast. The treachery of Judas caused them to adopt the former course. They went ahead and did it during the feast. The language implies that Judas appeared before the council and bargained openly with it. And so Judas is being pretty underhanded and sneaky here by bargaining with them for the price he would get paid to betray Jesus. In Matthew 26, verses 17 through 20, we continue on. Mark 14, 12 through 17, Luke 22, 7 through 13. Again, you mash up these passages in a New King James Version, and this is what it would look like without the superfluous text. Now, on the first day of the Feast of the Unleavened Bread, then came the day when they must kill the Passover lamb. And his disciples came to Jesus and said to him, "Where do you want us to go and prepare that you may eat the Passover?" And he sent out two of his disciples, Peter and John, and said to them, "Go into the city, and behold, when you have entered the city, a certain man will meet you, carrying a pitcher of water. Follow him into the house which he enters. Wherever he goes in, then you shall say to the master of the house, 'The teacher says, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at your house. Where is the guest room in which, or where I may eat the Passover with my disciples?' Then he will show you a large upper room, furnished and prepared, and there make ready for us. Go and prepare the Passover that we may eat." So his disciples went out and did as Jesus had directed them, and came into the city and found it just as he had said to them. And they prepared the Passover. And when the evening had come, he came and sat down with the 12. All right. Did you notice Jesus is a little bit vague with who this certain man is? He's never named. The location is never named other than it being he's going to lead you to an upper room. And one commentator that I read mentioned that perhaps he was being vague because he knew Judas was looking for the opportunity to betray him. And so he was being vague about who that man was when he told some of his disciples about it to kind of delay when that betrayal would take place. He wanted to eat this feast first. He wanted to share in this with his disciples. It had symbolic meaning, but he also institutes the Lord's Supper after this feast as well. And so these things need to occur before that betrayal takes place in the mission of Jesus. Mark.
Yeah, he was very vague in giving any kind of a name, but he was very specific that when he came into the city, there would be this man carrying water, which was not common. It would have been very uncommon. It would have been women that would have done this task, not a man.
Good point as well. Good point as well. So that would have been a something unique to have seen, for sure. Good. Steve?
The first thing out of Jesus' mouth before the dinner, he told everybody that he was going to receive it. That's the first thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. And we're gonna take a peek at that here in a minute, this little conversation they have about who is it going to be? Who's it going to be? Jesus has pointed it out. So typically, what would have been involved in preparing the Passover meal? Anybody ever just try to recreate a Passover meal? I always thought that'd be kind of interesting. Obviously, because of COVID, we're probably not going to do that anytime soon. But when things calm down, I think it'd be pretty cool just to kind of like actually make a meal just to kind of see what was it that these people would have been eating and drinking together on the Passover. So Take a look. I want to read to you from Barclay here, who talks about the Passover preparations. It's very small on my screen, so let me back up here and read it from up here. The whole week of which the Passover feast occupied, the first evening was called the Feast of Unleavened Bread. In following the events, we must remember that for the Jew, the next day began at 6 o'clock in the evening. In this case, the Feast of Unleavened Bread began on Thursday morning. On the Thursday morning, every particle of leaven was destroyed after a ceremonial search throughout the house. There was a double reason for that. The feast commemorated the greatest event in the history of Israel, the deliverance from slavery in Egypt. And when the Israelites had fled from Egypt, they had to flee in such haste that they had not time to bake their bread leavened. Dough without leaven, that's a little piece of fermented dough, it cooks very quickly. And so the leaven was banished and the bread unleavened to repeat the acts of the night on which they left Egypt and its slavery behind them. So it's one of the reasons it's called the Feast of Unleavened Bread. That's why they ate unleavened bread. It was to commemorate that event. Anybody ever at Thanksgiving, anybody ever make homemade rolls? That's That's like a necessary element of our Thanksgiving. My mom makes homemade rolls, but you got to have like a day. You got to make them the day before. You got to let them rise. It takes time. If anybody's ever made communion bread, though, you know, you just roll that thing out and you plop it down on the piece of, the aluminum pan, and you throw it in the oven, and 10 minutes later, you've got your bread. And so that was part of the purpose behind unleavened bread. That's why we partake of unleavened bread, by the way, because Jesus, when he instituted the Lord's Supper, would not have been taking leavened bread. He would have been eating unleavened bread. And so there was a couple purposes to that. Second, though, in Jewish thought, here's the second reason why they celebrated this Feast of Unleavened Bread. Leaven is the symbol of corruption. Leaven is fermented dough, and the Jews identified fermentation and putrefaction. So leaven stood for all that was rotten and corrupt, and was therefore a sign of putrefaction, cleansed away. When then were the preparations which the disciples would make? On the Thursday morning, they would prepare the unleavened bread and rid the house of every scrap of leaven. The other staple ingredient of the feast was the Passover lamb. It was indeed from the lamb that the feast took its name. On the Thursday afternoon, the lamb had to be taken to the temple and slain, and its blood, which was the life, had to be offered to God in sacrifice. And so that gives you a little bit more of a picture of the Passover preparations. There would have been some other things that are included in a typical Passover meal as well, but those are the two key things for our purposes that have some symbolic meaning when we think about Christ, the Lamb who was slain for our sins, the Lamb who was sinless, just like unleavened bread. Leavening symbolizes corruption. Jesus was not corrupt. The bread is a symbol of Jesus. The lamb is a symbol of who Jesus would be. And so there's some purpose, both looking backwards and looking forwards to Jesus, for us to consider. All right, now take a look at something that's only in the Luke text. This is Luke 22, 24 through 30. It says, "Now there was also a disciple among them a dispute..." I'm getting older. I used to be able to see really well. I'm missing words. "There was a dispute among them as to which of them should be considered the greatest. And he said to them, 'The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and those who exercise authority over them are called benefactors. But not so among you. On the contrary, he who is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he who governs as he who serves. For who is greater, he who sits at the table or he who serves? Is it not he who sits at the table? Yet I am among you as the one who serves. But you are those who have continued with me in my trials. And I bestow upon you a kingdom, just as my Father bestowed one upon me, that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel.'" So what dispute breaks out during the Passover meal? It seems like we're always having this very similar dispute among the disciples. What is it here? Who's going to be the greatest? So Jesus is talking about how he's going to be crucified, and he's talking about having a kingdom. And so the disciples are beginning to argue who's going to be one of the key leaders in that kingdom. They want to be promoted. What does Jesus have to remind them? And how is their argument at this time particularly foolish?
So in the larger context, Josh, their leader is about to be killed. They're at it in kind of weeks. So arguing over which apostle is the greatest, right? And not, hey, Jesus, you sounded a little bit concerned about your life.
Exactly. It was a very selfish conversation. Jesus is about to die, and he's just told you that. He just said, I'm going to be crucified, and you're arguing about who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom? Barnes has said this. He says, "Nothing can be more humiliating than that the disciples should have had such contentions, and in such a time and place, that just as Jesus was contemplating his own death and laboring to prepare them for it, they should strive and contend about office and rank. It shows how deeply seated is the love of power, how ambition will find its way into the most secret and sacred places, and how even the disciples of the meek and lowly Jesus are sometimes actuated by this most base and wicked feeling. But, you know, true greatness, according to Jesus, when you read this, look at verse 27 of Luke 22, and there again is a key word that Jesus shares. Luke 22 in verse 27. It says in verse 27, who is greater, he who sits at the table or he who serves? Is it not he who sits at the table? Yet I am among you as one who serves. So again, Jesus is emphasizing if you want to be great, it's not in position, it's in service. Serve, and you'll be considered great. In Luke 22 and verse 28, though, you are those who have continued with me in my trials. If you want to be great, it means you're going to be suffering, not ruling. So you're going to suffer for my kingdom's sake. And then in verses 29 and 30, I think part of true greatness, he says, is going to be patience. My Father is going to bestow upon you a kingdom, and one day you will be in a position of judgment, but that's not an immediate reward in this earthly kingdom. And so that's going to take time. So true greatness is going to take service, suffering, patience. And Jesus reinstills these ideas to them in this passage. Take a look at Matthew 26, 21 through 25. It says, as they sat and were eating, when Jesus had said these things, he was troubled in spirit and testified and said, most assuredly, I say to you, one of you who eats with me will betray me. And the disciples looked at one another, perplexed about whom he spoke. And they were exceedingly sorrowful, and each of them began to say to him one by one, Lord, is it I? We're throwing John into this as well, because I think John offered some extra dialogue to this conversation. Another said, is it I? And they began to question among themselves which of them it was who would do this thing. Now there was leaning on Jesus' bosom one of his disciples whom Jesus loved. So John sitting next to Jesus, actually probably reclining next to Jesus. This is how they would have sat and eaten at this time. Simon Peter therefore motioned to him to ask who it was of whom he spoke. So some people, as they picture this scene, would say Simon Peter was sitting across the table on the other side from John because he was far enough away that he could not personally ask Jesus this. So he says something to John like, who's he talking about? Ask him who he's talking about. And so, leaning on Jesus' breast, he said to him, Lord, who is it? And Jesus answered and said, but behold, the hand of my betrayer is with me on the table. There's one of the 12. He who dipped his hand with me in the dish will betray me. It is he to whom I shall give a piece of bread when I have dipped it. And truly the Son of Man indeed goes just as it is written of him, and as it has been determined, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been good for that man if he'd never been born. Having dipped the bread, he gave it to Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon. And Judas, who was betraying him, answered and said, Rabbi, is it I? And he said to him, you have said it. So Jesus reveals who it is who's going to betray him, whether that sinks in or not, not sure. But this is troubling to Jesus. He's eating a meal, his last meal with his closest friends, and sitting with him in that meal is someone who is going to be the cause for why he would be betrayed. Interesting to me is that Jesus knows all of this is going to happen. And what has he done? When you read the John text, which we're not including the John text in our synoptic gospel study, because we're really just studying Matthew, Mark, Luke. But the John text, I think, is pretty vital here, because what had Jesus just done prior to eating this meal? They washed their feet. Yeah, he washed all of his disciples' feet, which was an act of humility. It was an act of service. It was an act of kindness. And among the people whose feet he must have washed would have been Judas. And so Jesus still offers this act of honor and this act of love towards someone whom he knew was going to treat him in an evil way. And I think that's an important principle for us to consider. as we think about how do we treat our enemies. Jesus still treated someone who he knew he was pretending to be a friend but was truly an enemy, still treated him with love and with respect, even though he knew something that was greatly troubling him at this dinner. I want you to picture this before we close here, because I want to, has anybody ever seen Leonardo, of course you have, Leonardo da Vinci's painting, The Last Supper? It's terrible. It's terrible. It's not biblically accurate. It's not historically accurate, but it's a very popular painting. So I want you to just picture the real scene. Since Jewish days began at sundown, this is, I'm reading to you from Chumley because he'll help you picture it. When the even was come, it signaled the start of the 14th day of the month, the time when Passover was to be eaten. He quotes here from Blumberg, and he says, "We are not to envisage, with Leonardo da Vinci's famous Renaissance portrait of the Last Supper, one long table with people sitting on chairs on either side of it, but rather the triclinium. This was a square-cornered, U-shaped combination of three cushions on which people would recline, lying on their sides with their bodies perpendicular to the cushions and stretched outward away from the center of the room. The food was placed in the middle of the U in between the couches, and at some point during the meal, Jesus drops the bombshell." That's the betrayal. So look at Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper portrait. Totally not accurate. By the way, that's leavened bread on the table too. So that's not right. And who sits all on one side of the table like that? But I'm sure he did that because he's trying to get the, you know, the portrait of each and every apostle and trying to get us to see their facial expressions and how they were all reacting differently to Jesus. But this is a more accurate picture of what the scene would have looked like, where you have a U-shaped table, and they didn't sit like we do when we go to a, you know, restaurant or when we eat at our dining room tables. We sit in a chair. They would have laid on their sides. And that's why it mentions John, the disciple whom Jesus loved, leaning over to Jesus, because Jesus, they were all just kind of laying around a table. And so he would have just kind of leaned over while he was laying on his side and said to Jesus, "Lord, who is it?" And Jesus would have been close enough to have told him specifically, "Here's who it is. And I'll give you a little sign. The person who I give a piece of bread to, that's the one who's going to betray me." And so this is a more realistic scene. You've got the food in the middle, and you've got them, you know, laying around on this kind of some cushions around the side of the table, and very close, a very intimate picture or setting. So this is what should be in our head when we think of the last Passover, more so than everybody sitting on one side of a table eating leavened bread. Okay? All right. So I just wanted to make sure we got to that before we got done here. But the disciples begin to question, who is it? Jesus tells them who it is. Let's read this last section of text just so that we've read everything that we are going to read today. Jesus said to them, "All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night." You know, when they ask the question, "Lord, who is it?" Well, Jesus tells them who the betrayer is. But the truth is, all of them forsook Jesus. All of them abandoned him. And so he tells them right here, well, we can point our fingers at Judas, and yes, he guilty of perhaps a greater sin for being so devious. The disciples just acted out of fear. But all of you, he says, will be made to stumble because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee. So Jesus is already talking about his resurrection here. Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, where are you going?" Jesus said, "Where I am going, you cannot follow me now, but you shall follow me afterward." Peter answered and said, "Lord, why can I not follow you now? Even if all men are made to stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble." And the Lord said, "Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you, that he may sift you as wheat, but I have prayed for you, that your faith should not fail. And when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren." But he said to him, "Lord, I am ready to go with you both to prison and to death. I will lay down my life for your sake." And Jesus said, "Will you lay down your life for my sake? Most assuredly, I tell you, Peter, that today, even this night, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times that you know me." But Peter spoke more vehemently, said, "Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you." And so said all the disciples likewise. Well, we know what happened. He does deny him. Just wanted to get to this last section of text here, where Jesus not only reveals his betrayer, but he reveals the denial of Peter. He reveals the abandonment of all of his disciples. And so all of them truly, in some sense, failed Jesus on this night of suffering. All right, thank you for your attention. We'll pick up